Welcome to The Nose. I'll tell you who's on The Nose, but first let me tell you what we're going to be talking about today. A little bit later on the show, we'll be talking about the short fall of Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon's still fine, but he's losing ground in the ratings, seems to be losing ground in the zeitgeist, kind of at a moment when I think to a certain degree, certain other people have found the sweet spot, the way to talk about culture in a way that he hasn't right now. Jimmy Kimmel in particular seems to be having a Goldilocks moment. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about our own kind of very late to the party discovery of Chris Cornell, the musical artist who died this week, associated with Soundgarden, Audioslave, and also a burgeoning solo career. But I think we're going to talk about that more in terms of the way we don't know each other's music that well anymore. But we're going to begin with I Love Dick. I Love Dick is an 8-part TV series on Amazon. It is created by Jill Soloway, best known prior to this as the auteur behind Transparent. It takes place in Marfa, Texas. Marfa, Texas has become a hyper-precious arts and ideas community for the people who think South by Southwest is way too crowded and don't feel like going to Aspen. Marfa's the place basically you can't get to in less than 15 hours. So it kind of weeds out the people with low commitment. So Marfa's a real place and it's a real scene. This satirizes it, and it satirizes it within the framework of a hyped up and somewhat lost and confused New York-based filmmaker played by Catherine Hahn, who arrives in Marfa with her husband, an intellectual played by Griffin Dunne, and immediately becomes obsessed with one of the kind of reigning figures of this Marfa scene, the ultimate smart girl accessory, a rangy, stringy cowboy artist played by Kevin Bacon. There are other characters we'll talk about as well. Some of the series is about the triangle that forms among the three actors I've just named. A lot of it also is about, I think, blocked creativity Let's figure out together what else it's about. I don't know what it's about. I know what I think it's about. Joining us right now is Rich Holland. Rich Holland is a principal and design director at CoLab. Carolyn Payne, actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance, and many other things besides, and soon to be coming to a screen near you. Maybe we'll have a chance to mention that at some point today. Is it ready to be mentioned?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll mention that later. Yeah. And Irene Papoulas teaches writing at Trinity College. So here we go. I've set it up as well as I can. I should also say, Irene, that it's based on a book which you made a point of acquiring.
Yes. When I first read about the series in the New York Times a few months ago, I was like, I have to get this book. So I did. It's not a book that I would recommend to most people because it's she writes a lot of letters. It's about this guy named Dick. And it's from the perspective of a certain kind of woman that would be obsessed with somebody. And if I might, I just have to read. If you like this passage, you would like the book. All right. OD, it's Thursday morning, 9 a.m. And I feel so emotional about this writing. Last night I replaced you with an orange candle because I felt you weren't listening anymore. But I still need for you to listen because, don't you see, no one is. I'm completely illegitimate. So if you can relate to that feeling, you might like the book. Otherwise,
you can just get it and take a picture and Instagram yourself.
Explain that phenomenon in the most PG-13 way you can.
Absolutely. So my first introduction to this book was people Instagramming themselves with it, taking selfies with the book, with the title I Love Dick, coming up with witty hashtags. Some of them did make like a feminist, because it is a feminist-driven novel in some ways, and but people would make some sort of claim to being a feminist on Instagram by reading this book and holding it up and taking ridiculous selfies and filtering them with duck face and this book. So that's how I became aware of this book, which obviously put it to me in kind of I didn't even think it was a real book. I thought it was some sort of internet joke.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah,
because the title. Yeah, but I also think it's really interesting that they transposed it to 2017 because the book was written. She wrote it in the 90s when she was about 40. So she's of a certain generation, a sort of boomer generation, and a certain kind of corner of the art world of all these women that made sure to see all these Maya Darren movies, with women lying at the ocean's edge, kind of staring into space romantically and then just watching them for a while in movies like that. So those of us who can relate to that kind of thing sort of would feel a certain kind of attachment. But to transpose that to 2017, to the 21st century, I think it makes it easy to ridicule in a way that I also can participate in, but I also feel, wait a minute, she was trying to do something.
Well, I think that there is some sort of disconnect. I think that in the TVs, now I have not read the book, but in the series, I had a lot of trouble relating to this character and kind of understanding where she was coming from.
Well, let's, I want to hear Rich on this too, but let's get to know the TV series a little tiny bit here. This is from the very first episode of the TV series, and we see the actress played by the filmmaker played by Catherine Hahn in one of her first encounters with Dick. Dick is this moody cowboy artist and sort of the Lord Supreme of the Marfa art scene, played by Kevin Bacon.
My guess. Because she doesn't want to be a filmmaker. Because if you want to be a filmmaker, you'd be one. Oh. It's just a question of desire, not timing or talent or circumstance. It's pure want, which you don't possess. And don't confuse desire with entitlement around your filmmaking. Am I wrong?
It's also a question of finances.
All it took was desire, Dick. There would be a trove of amazing films by women filmmakers, but no.
Well, unfortunately, most films made by women aren't that good. See, I think it's really pretty rare for a woman to make a good film because they have to work from behind their oppression, which makes for some bummer movies.
Sally Potter, Jane Campion. Excuse me.
Susan Sontag, she was great.
So that's all three voices from the film. Actually, you hear Griffin Dunne talking as well as the somewhat beleaguered husband of Catherine Hahn. So, you know, there's so many ways to go in at this, Rich. I don't know. Could we begin just talking about these performances? I actually, Irene and I have both finished the series now, you and Carolyn about halfway through. But I actually think all of these people are giving really remarkable performances. Catherine Hahn is memorable to people who watched Transparent, where she plays the sexy rabbi. I need say nothing more than those two words. You know exactly who I'm talking about. Griffin Dunne, of course, the son of Dominic Dunne from Hartford and been in lots of movies, but you haven't seen him in anything in a while. Kevin Bacon, we don't have to tell you who Kevin Bacon is. I feel like they're all giving really remarkable performances.
They're doing a great job. Catherine Hahn has a lot to carry in this movie, and she plays herself and her antithesis in this movie, and that's always a sort of complicated thing to do. On one level, and you know, this is me speaking personally as always, I think that she's sexy as hell, and she embodies that sort of robust sensuality. And then manages on a dime to turn it into this clumsy, oafish thing. And you just can't quite pin her down. You can't pin her authenticity down. You can't pin her struggle down.
Well, do you believe that as the character, having those two? Or do you feel like
absolutely.
That's the acting?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the whole thing just kind of wraps really nicely. If there were any struggle I would have with all of this is with some of the writing. I think that there's this tendency, and you could hear it in that clip, men are idiots in this, as far as I see. They say things that are harsh and brash and myopic. And meanwhile, these women are exploring all of these corners and all of these complexity and guys, to quote Kevin Bacon in this movie in reference to his artwork, I like straight lines, they can make statements like that and not be challenged. They can make statements like what I think is my favorite line in this is when Kevin Bacon declares that he is post-idea.
Right.
And that's completely acceptable. And yet, when the women are struggling with similar kinds of tensions and conflicts and presenting their process live, it's completely unacceptable.
See, I want to sort of play with that for just a second, Carolyn. Actually, I had a slightly different reaction, and it may be conditioned a little bit by having gotten all the way through, where the men get a little bit of redemption. I think they creep towards some redemption as they go along. But first of all, I'm a big Catherine Hahn fan from Transparent. In this, If there's a problem that I have with this series, it's Catherine Hahn. I find her a little hard to watch at times. Mm-hmm. This performance is so hyped up and mannered, and she's kind of like Woody Allen on cocaine. And she's verbally thrashing around. She's physically thrashing around. And she's simultaneously great and a little bit hard to watch for more than 3 or 4 minutes.
I agree with you. I found her to be – normally I find her – incredibly just kind of like just this easy realness that she just gets across in her performances. Like she's been really consistent for me, and I think she's like a really strong comedian. I think she's a mess in this. And I don't know if this is what they – like her hair is a mess. She looks a mess. Her performance just seems like sloppy sometimes. Like it's just missing a mark. Like I don't know if that – is a character that she was creating, if that was directed out of her, if this is just kind of like a miss in some ways. But there was just something really like out of control for her in this that I couldn't grasp.
All right. Well, and I would say that goes back to the original book, because she was really playing that character. And I think mm-hmm. that character is really hard to watch. Mm-hmm. That's the same reason why the book is hard to read, because you just want to say, oh, come on, you know, and she's just like, let me scrape it against the bone a little bit more, like just pushing and pushing and pushing. And even though some part of me relates to that, I also can just feel like, oh, come on, stop. Just, you know, just comb your hair. Yeah.
But yeah. Didn't you say, oh, come on, through the entire 90s?
That would be a yes. That's a solid yes.
Well, actually, I'm also shortchanging somebody. There's a fourth performance that's worth talking about here, and really is a whole other leg of this series. A virtual unknown named Roberta Calindra is playing Devon. Devon is a lesbian artist / playwriter, but somebody much more rooted in this community, not an out-of-towner slumming in the high desert, but someone who's really from there and somebody who's really going through her own crisis about who she's going to be and how she's going to make her mark on the world. This performance, in a way, see, one of the things that, Rich, that I like about Catherine Hahn usually is that I want more. With Transparent, I thought, I want even more of her. I want to see that character more. I want to know more about that character. Whereas in this role, she kind of vomits up everything about herself. You know, every single time the camera looks at her, she's just like vomiting up everything. Whereas there is a real mystery to this character, Devon. I really, as some of her story is revealed, I feel like I'm on this very interesting date where I'm getting to know this person in a very slow and measured and mm-hmm. fascinating fashion. I was throwing that at you.
Okay. Yeah, I'll accept that. There's a thing that we were discussing just before the show started, and it's a personal thing that I get intimidated by people who have their act together, and particularly if they're tall. and so the sloppier you get, the happier I get and the more comfortable I become.
Right.
And
what should we make of the fact that Rich seems to be not intimidated by any of us?
Well, yeah, what he described was like me entirely. I am a short mess.
And he seems to have his act together really well, too. Yeah.
It's all a lie.
Yeah.
Well, I also want to talk, Irene, a little bit about what's being made fun of here. Like something's being made fun of, and it's done very well. And in a lot of this show, I'm laughing. Although half the time I sort of want to hit the pause button and think a little bit about what I'm laughing at. Mm-hmm. Clearly, one thing that's being made fun of is kind of the state of the modern hyper-intellectual community, right? That there's, first of all, this series is like a crash course in post-feminist filmmaking, the state of women-created fine arts in America. Many names are dropped that I didn't recognize or had to look up or had to figure out. But while all that's happening, there's something intensely silly about this Marfa scene, which is a real-life scene. I mean, she's, first of all, making fun of a scene that I think most people are completely unaware of. I mean, you have to tell people that Marfa, Texas is a real thing.
I had to Google that. And, and as often I do with things on the show, I had to Google and see what was happening. But this show kind of had a Portlandia vibe to me, but it was like Marfandia, which is an awful word. But do you know what I mean? Like, you know, like that show Portlandia sort of takes this like hipster artsy culture and the characters that surround it and make it. And this show kind of, at least in the first couple episodes, there was that vibe for me, like this
But, okay, go ahead.
No, no, well,
all right. So there, it's also the thing about the visiting, like the intellectual community, mm-hmm. you know, where everybody, there's these fellows, they're called fellows, you know, and they're all here and they're all here to have discussions. And the first scene is so funny because she doesn't want to go to the party and meet all the people because she's the wife of the fellow, but she's there and she doesn't want to be there. And the way they see her, oh, you're the... Oh,
the wife
she's
of the Holocaust
wife.
Guy.
Oh, you like my, you
the
know,
Holocaust
you'd
wife.
Like my wife, the Holocaust wife, because that's what he works on, and just the awkwardness of those kind of those kind of events where you're supposed to be sort of schmoozing with people, and they're all sort of sizing each other up and feeling awkward and uncomfortable. It's funny because it's so. Because it happens so much, and everybody has to pretend that they're like the kind of people that Rich is intimidated by, even though they're not.
Yeah, I think that every sort of subculture, for lack of better words, is mockable until you're in it.
Or sometimes even if you are.
Well, sure, that's fair. But I think that there is something that grows out of that kind of extreme introspection and analysis of things that has tremendous value. The struggle that I have with this series is I could hang into this study of obsession and this study of, you know, of what do you do when you don't fit in? How do you claim your own? A heck of a lot more than I could settle in with the context that they're playing this out in. I think we've also been having this conversation about this this painting recently that sold for $110 million plus. And
this is Jean-Michel
Basquiat's
Untitled.
Yeah. And setting a new kind of record, but it seems like there's other stuff that sold for more, so I don't quite understand the record. But nevertheless, what's the kind of intellectual over-discipline that happens in some of these places is setting the bed for this kind of economic driver to happen. You know, that once we could actually start defining, getting clear on the vocabulary for discussing these achievements, for discussing these issues, we create a context for more of that to happen.
I do want to, you know, when I was thinking today that I'm ready to go back and watch the Basquiat movie, which I had forgotten. It stars Jeffrey Wright, who's gone on to have this tremendous career as Basquiat, and Benicio del Toro is his buddy from the hood who shoots hoops with him, you know, in some neighborhood in New York. And I think David Bowie is
Andy Warhol,
right? Yeah. And I mean, just like this amazing cast. And I kind of do want to go and see it because I think in some ways – my dim recollection of that movie is that it does prick the sensibilities a little bit of the Warhol-dominated part of – I mean, because Basquiat is coming in from the streets with a very different kind of, you know, very earthy kind of vision. In a way, he's sort of, you know, the Kevin Bacon of New York City. He's, like, real. He's trying to be real anyway. Right. But all of this seems – the minute you say it, it sounds kind of mockable to use your
– Right, exactly. You know, and when you take a look at how – even in that movie, how the factory scene was drawn, it seemed completely ridiculous. But such incredible value actually came out of that. I am hoping that as the series evolves, we can start seeing some of the value that comes out of some out of the exercises that are going through in Marfa.
Well, actually, just to sort of maybe wrap this up because – we've got a couple of other interesting topics we want to get to. But so, Irene, you and I, first of all, we'll start with the people who haven't finished. Carolyn, one of the things that I will say is that as I was watching this unfold, and I had this experience with Jill Soloway's work generally, there are episodes that make me want to keep going and episodes that make me think, eh, I don't really care whether I see this to the end or not. And they alternate often. But she hasn't really, I get the feeling she hasn't really set the hook for you.
At all. I mean, honestly, like, I probably, if I didn't have to discuss this today, I probably would have stopped in the middle of episode one. Just well. Real talk here. Like, I had to push myself to get, and then, like, episode two, I was like, all right, I'm kind of on board. I, like, sort of want to see what happens. But it just, for me, like, I couldn't, the soundtrack is great. Like, the whole thing has this, like, pretty Instagram filter in the film style. But I couldn't, and the acting, Kevin Bacon is good in it. He's really, I thought he was really interesting. And yeah. I find something about him fascinating. Like, his face and his expressions and everything about him, I think, is fascinating in this. But Yeah, I mean, definitely is the kind of thing, like, check it out and see if it hooks you in, but I'll be probably not finishing this.
Bacon gets better and better in this role and fleshes out his character to a tremendous degree. It might be my favorite performance of his that I've seen ever by the time he's done with it. So, Rich, how about you? Are you are you here for the stay? Or
I'm here for the stay. Yeah. I was a little tentative at the I wasn't sure about the first episode. Because, you know, you're doing all this setup, and there's also, from a director's point of view, the first episode was just massively overly directed. There were these freeze frames that were happening. It was just too much packed into a very small amount of time. But it's starting to even out. It's established its vocabulary by the second episode, and it's easy to take in, and I just want to see where these characters go. And to your point about the Chris character, Catherine Hahn's character in this, she just keeps throwing up more stuff over and over again. And I'm just wondering what happens when we get to the bottom of that well.
Right. It's so now we get to may even sort of make a recommendation one way or the other. We've been all the way through. I mean, would you recommend this to most people, some people? You had some qualifications about the book. How about the TV series?
No, and the movies. Actually, I think in a way, when I first in the first couple of episodes, I had a feeling that wasn't completely different from Carolyn's in the sense of saying, like, because I felt like they were making fun of it too much. It was just too cynical. Yeah. I thought, but as if you go all the way through to the end, it tried to redeem itself, and I think her performance, the sort of desperation of her performance, I think is just so great, and it's sort of asking the question about, like, what is a real emotion in the first place? You know, where are the real emotions and what is real art, too? I think it's trying to ask. And so I really admire it for that. I don't think it's perfect, but I really admire it for that. So, yes, I would recommend it.
I just want to say that I would recommend it. I think, first of all, it's a series that will, within three episodes, sort you out pretty quickly. You know, I mean, the people who don't want to watch this, they're going to know within maybe even halfway through the first episode, to Carolyn's point. And it is, a lot of it depends on what you're up for. And I think this series, I'm, first of all, amazed that this got made. You know, even at Amazon, to pitch something like this, because once you get past the sexy title, the sexy funny title, there's a lot of hard going intellectually in this. I mean, you're rewarded constantly by interesting, funny people. But, I mean, really, I had to look up a ton of stuff just to even understand some of the references that were being made. I didn't know who Chantal Ackerman is. I mean, you really...
I have to say, I feel like they are just, like, trying to dupe people into watching this based on the funny title and the picture, like the ad that's, like, on the billboards and everything, right. The, like, lipstick and the bullet. That, to me, as I started watching it, became more and more bizarre. Like, I felt like that was gimmicky and unnecessary for this.
Anyway, its brains are in evidence all the way through. I think its heart grows bigger as it goes along, and you really start to maybe believe in these people. Griffin Dunne, I have to say, is also really, really good in this. It's a very, very interestingly calibrated performance by him. He's just terrific, and so it's fun to watch him. He's also left-handed. I always have to point out who's left-handed. All right.
Can I add one recommendation to this? Is if the kids are awake, lower the volume. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. That's probably a pretty good idea. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We've got two more topics that we need to tackle.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone.
All right, so we talked about how maybe audiences sort themselves out, either liking or not liking I Love Dick. By the way, the thing you heard at the end of the last little bit of the previous segment was, in fact, Marlene Dietrich singing Where Have All the Flowers Gone, part of the eclectic and hypnotic soundtrack to I Love Dick. All right, but another way we sort ourselves out, I think, is sort of what our late-night choices are, because you have a lot of late-night choices these days in terms of comedy. I mean, you can not watch it at all, which is what a lot of people do. But otherwise, you're a Colbert person, you're a Fallon person, you're a Kimmel person. We could throw in a few others. And right now, it does seem, and the New York Times made quite a bit of hay about this week in a piece by David Skoff, that Fallon's having a little bit of a fall, that his ratings aren't as good as they used to, but maybe a little bit more more importantly, because his ratings will always be good enough to guarantee him employment. But there's sort of a sense in which he's missing the mark here somehow, that the kind of show that he puts together isn't necessarily the kind of show that people want to see and talk about and relish right now. I'll still go around the table. I mean, Rich, I'll start with you. I mean, first of all, where do you land on all this stuff?
Well, I've never been very much of a Fallon fan, in the same way I wasn't very much of a Jimmy Carson fan. It didn't speak to the stuff that's of interest to me. That said, it's going to topple. What I think needs to happen for all of these folks is you need a brand that has some diversity to it, that has some range. And Fallon's been playing to an incredibly, incredibly narrow range all along. It's a little opey, it's a little aw shucks, and you know, in a time that's calling for, you know, protestation by and large, you're going to find that happening. I'm finding that, you know, even in sort of my own experiences, the folks who are saying, you know, oh, just get away from the politics, ignore that stuff, just go out and smell the flowers, are folks that are getting dismissed pretty quickly in my life. And I think that we're in a place where that's happening more and more.
I totally agree. But I think, I mean, I'm a Trevor Noah person. Mm-hmm. He is so good. Last night he was just so, I mean, every night he's so, so, so good, I think. And he has, you know, what you would like. But for me, I think I know when Jimmy Fallon when the slide began, which was when he mussed Trump's hair.
Yes.
You know, and it was just so, everybody was just shocked that he was being so playful.
This is during the campaign. He had sit-downs with both candidates. A lot of softball questions, not a lot of hardball questions, but I think that was sort of maybe understood going in. But yeah, he did. He wanted to experience the reality of Donald Trump's hair.
And actually, I thought in a way it was a pretty funny thing to do, because it seems like Donald Trump is vain about his hair. He's he's you know, uncomfortable about it, you know. And so just to say, hey, can I touch your hair and can I muss it up? But people, myself included, felt like, no, that's too much chumminess.
Yeah.
So, Carolyn,
that was scripted.
As the comedy professional here.
Yeah.
So the comedy landscape is huge, you know, and there's a lot of room for people to mine different parts of it. At least typically there is. And there's really never been any real burden borne by late night comedy to comment meaningfully about the political scene, unless you're talking about Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and now Trevor Noah.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like, you know.
And Samantha Bee. I always feel like I have to like throw her in. She's my favorite, and I always want her to get a solid shout out.
Right. Although she's weekly. I see people who work daily, we identify with the daily.
That is, I know, and I appreciate the like grind of a daily show, but I almost feel like it's enough for me that it is weekly. I have never been a late night TV watcher, to be honest. I feel like, you know, when I was like in high school and college, you had like Letterman and Leno, and I never really watched it. So I've never gotten into a pattern. The only thing I see of late night is like the morning after, if people are sharing it on their social media. So I feel like I think that is true for a lot of people in my age group, that, you know, we're going to just kind of get like a clip of the best of what happened. So I feel like that's how I look at it. Like if I see, like this week, Jimmy Fallon broke where Trump's commencement speech was like Elle Woods from Legally Blonde.
Actually, let's hear that right
now.
That
was so funny.
But I watched Trump's commencement speech and it sounded kind of familiar. I think it actually reminded me of Elle Woods' speech from Legally Blonde. See if you can tell what I mean.
We take our next steps into the world.
You must go forth into the world.
It is with passion.
Passion.
Courage of conviction.
Courage in your convictions.
And most importantly.
Most importantly.
Have faith in yourself.
Be true to yourself.
We did it!
I did it.
What is going on?
It's probably just a coincidence. It's probably just a coincidence.
Oh, my God.
I don't even know how we connected the two or whoever wrote that. That's fantastic.
So that's really great. And we maybe even wish that Jimmy did even more of that kind of thing.
Yes.
Although he's very, I mean, Jimmy Fallon's very good at certain things. He's a fabulous impressionist. You know, his musical impersonations are just legendary and justifiably so. Although I have always found him to be kind of disturbingly lightweight. Even even within the context of Saturday Night Live, he seemed kind of lightweight. He was
always breaking.
Yeah, a source of frustration. Tracy Morgan and other performers who worked with him called him eventually on the fact that he broke character all the time and would dissolve into giggles in a script that needed something a little bit more from him. And I do think that, you know, late night television is an odd place. And so, you know, some people are going to gravitate towards the Trevor Noahs of this world. But a lot of people are looking for the last thing they're going to watch before they fall asleep. They don't necessarily want the gears of their brains grinding over anything terribly complex. On the other hand, you know, Trump is such a pervasive conversational presence that you can't ignore him. It's sort of why I think, you know, Jimmy Kimmel recently just got renewed for the Oscars for a second straight time, which has not happened very much in recent years. And I feel like Kimmel's found this little sweet spot here. He's kind of a little bit more middle American. You know, he's having the Goldilocks moment. He's, you know, he had the thing with his own child's heart condition where he spoke very profoundly and personally about this and in a way that was very finger-wagging at the Trump and Republican health care plan. And I think that maybe sort of undergirded him a little bit so that, you know, he prior to that, I would have said he wasn't too much more topical or incisive or biting than Fallon. But now it's sort of like, I don't know, I'm like more intrigued by Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, I do think that kind of, to be honest, I forgot he was still on the air until I saw those clips. I feel like there's so many options now. And, you know, there's a late show and a late, late show. And then there are cable shows. And there's just so many choices. So you have to really find something that is your niche and stick with it and figure out what makes you funny and how you can cope with what is happening and make it funny.
Yeah.
And I think like Jimmy Fallon, you know, I think that his kind of, I think you said in an email, Rich, his Pee Wee Herman persona of this like man child that he has going on, I think he is going to have to start to evolve that a little to keep up.
It's, on the other hand, I do feel as though – so one thing that I've been thinking watching Kimmel recently is when you lose Jimmy Kimmel, you've lost middle America. You know, kind of the way when Walter Cronkite finally said, look, the Vietnam War is just not working out. It was like everyone went, whoa. And there's a way in which, you know, Stephen Colbert doesn't have anything left to throw at Trump. He's thrown everything he's got. He can just throw everything every night, night after night after night. And you know, with people – somebody like Kimmel, you can sort of imagine the more caustic he becomes about Trump, the more he's speaking maybe for middle America. And yeah, I just don't think Jimmy Fallon is ready to put those man pants on yet. All right, we're going to do a quick topic switch. This week, Chris Cornell died. He's perhaps not a name that means anything to you. I will confess his name meant essentially nothing to me, although I did know the names of Soundgarden and Audioslave, two bands in which he participated, and I guess therefore I kind of maybe sort of almost knew he was part of the grunge scene. Since then, I've made an effort to discover his work. And maybe before we discuss that fact, let's hear, this is by Soundgarden, this is called Spoon Man. So that's your grunge. So first of all, I think probably age-wise, Carolyn, you might be our best hope of somebody who has any relationship with this music at all.
Sorry, I might
be. You do?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm a little...
too young.
Grunge took off, like I was in like late elementary like to junior high. And so grunge was like what you aspired to be cool.
Yeah.
You know, like we were wearing flannel shirts over our Nirvana tees, but not really quite there knowing what we were listening to.
Yeah, I may have you in the wrong age cohort because you were on our David Bowie show. That was the first time you appeared on this particular radio program, I think.
Right.
So you're a little bit more in the grunge pipeline.
Yeah, I'm in that mid-50s age group. And I'm singing along to Spoon Man on the radio here. And this morning I was listening to stuff like Black Hole Sun, acoustic. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what I need right now because my bones
are
old.
That is a great song.
It is an amazing song.
And
so that movement was incredibly important. We needed to figure out what to do. New Age created a disaster for folks who wanted to be very sort of viscerally awake. Mm-hmm. And so coming out of this sort of punk phase, and you know what we ended up with was, you know, was like Big Shoulder Pads and Boy George, and you know, and an awful lot of what was happening in those mid 80s points. Boy, when folks like, you know, like Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and you know, and when these folks came back on the scene in a more popular way, not just an underground way that's hard to access, it connected folks like me back to what our roots were. So this is kind of a big deal moment. Now the interesting thing that's happening for me is as I was getting connected to Chris Connell, to Chris as a solo artist for the show, I spent the bulk of a day just listening to him do covers.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I had not recognized, you know, because of all the sort of dynamic compression and intensity of the production that happens with bands like Soundgarden, to actually hear his voice clean.
I was
shocked. It's a remarkable tool. It's a remarkable instrument.
He's kind of the Placido Domingo of grunge. I mean, he's. I was listening to him sing Ave Maria with 11 as I pulled into the parking lot just now. But, I mean, Irene, I think this also speaks to the fact that and I've discovered this a lot while when we've done, usually when somebody dies, but not always, but when we do stuff on the nose, we always have the panelists picked before we know what we're going to talk about. On one occasion, Mercy Quay down in New Haven, who's a young African-American woman, we were going to be talking about Paul Simon. He hadn't died, but he had a new album out, and she said she had to ask people who that was. She didn't know who Paul Simon was. Tanisha Dugan didn't know who Leonard Cohen was. I didn't know who Chris Cornell was, and I don't think you did either. And it sort of speaks to these silos we're in musically. Mm-hmm. It is that somebody could be that meaningful to people who live and work and socialize around you and me, and for us not to really even know who that is. I don't know. How does that happen?
I know. And it's not only generational. It's somewhat generational. Though I have to just, as a parenthesis, say, like, that song that you just played reminded me of Long Island acid rock from when I was in high school. Like, Mountain, Felix Popularity and Mountain, mm-hmm. you know, it was the same kind of guitar, you know, that I personally used to love. So I
Soundgarden often sounds like Cream to me.
Cream, yeah. And yeah, like Jimi Hendrix with some of it. And anyway, so in a way, you said that you went back to it, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how the types of music go in cycles, and now there's
like
neo-disco.
Whereas like grunge was kind of my awakening to music. Mm-hmm. I do feel like because that was like the first time that I, you know, that was the age where you're aware of and starting to develop taste and everything. So I feel like grunge was my like music awakening.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to hear that for you, it like took you back.
Yeah.
Grunge is, I feel like, what got me.
Yeah.
But and it's an interesting, you know, like I feel like I was thinking about that for me, like what kind of, you know, I've boyfriends influenced it so much. You know, I had my jazz boyfriend in college, and I had my reggae boyfriend, and then I had my Motown, and then I had my indie rock.
This is starting to sound like an episode of I Love Dick.
Yes.
Go ahead and write them some letters.
And so those are all, you know, those are my silos in a way, you know, like what were they listening to more than what I was, you know. I've never been on Spotify or some one of those things. And I always say that I should be, you know, because I usually just sort of take in music from what other people. There's some that I follow on my own, but I don't know. So. Yeah. Anyway, it's who your friend, who you value, and also certain kinds of music are associated with a certain kind of coolness or way of being, and so I think that it's who you're attracted to in terms of that.
Right. I mean, for me, I feel like for many years now, soundtracks are a huge influence in what I listen to. Like, I'll hear a song, and then I'll look that up and look up that artist, and you know, just kind of like fall in love with things from that. I think that I agree with Irene that like a lot of who you like, it relates to people that introduced it to you, or like, you know, if you had a really good summer, like you remember the songs from that summer. or just a time in your life where you remember like certain songs that go with that. And I think that that's kind of.
But maybe there's less universalization of that now. Yeah. You know, like you don't. It's not. We don't all hear the same anything.
Right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely the case. And I think it's also never been easier to discover new music, and never been harder too. There. You know, if you're gonna make the effort. I mean, one thing that I'll say is so my streaming service. Is Tidal. That's T-I-D-A-L. And one of the things that they did right away is cough up for me this very nice Chris Cornell playlist that starts with, and it's a mix, you know, it starts with Can't Change Me, which is from one of his solo efforts. But then there's some Soundgarden and some Audioslave and Temple of the Dog, which we're going to go out of this segment with, and some of his collaborations with Zac Brown. He liked to collaborate with lots of different people. So, I mean, and I just started listening to it, and I thought, well, why didn't I listen to any of this ever before? But I was really quite captivated by it. I mean, one of the things that I do with streaming services now, my streaming services, I use it to force myself to learn about music that I'm not going to learn about. Because I think we don't do it by osmosis anymore.
No,
you have to claw your way in.
Yeah, that's kind of the way. Yeah. Back in the day, there was this thing called a record store.
Right.
And I used to, it was almost sort of like instead of like folks go to the gym now, I would go to the record store and just start at A, and some of these weren't organized by section, so all the A's were together, and if I saw something that looked interesting, I'd buy it. Mm-hmm. And I heard all kinds of fascinating things, so I'm trying
reading
to replicate
the album covers and everything. Yeah. Was so great. Yeah.
You know, and so I'm trying to replicate that with Spotify. It's, you know, I'm having some success of hearing things that I wouldn't ordinarily stumble into. You know, I found this new electronic stuff called by a performer called FKA Twigs.
Yes.
Go listen to that. Oh, my God. She's amazing.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, one thing. Sorry.
But it has nothing to do with Soundgarden.
Okay, right. Well, I also have to say that it's so annoying because some people, as they get older, sort of hold on to the music they like and they scoff at anything else and they refuse to listen to it. And I think that's really frustrating, too, that people just get so locked in that they want to stay in there. You know, like, no, don't play any of that other music. Yeah. I can't relate to that kind of music. And that just bothers me.
All right. So we're going to have to take a break here, I think, just in order to. I do want to say, first of all, that so I don't get 15 emails about this, that there are still some of the great record stores left, including Red Door. Red Scroll. I knew it was either Red Door or Red Scroll. I actually did know it was one of those two. It's Red Scroll. There's that wonderful walk down place too up in Northampton, Massachusetts. I mean, once again, you have to claw your way to these places and find them, but they still do exist, and you can go hang out and pretend that you're the young Rich Holland. Meanwhile, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to make some recommendations.
I'm still reeling from the disclosure that I Love Dick has nothing to do with Senator Blumenthal. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The post-feminist films of Amanda Fish are available on our website, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Zeppo Bacon. We'll be back on Monday trying to piece together what happened when the president went to Saudi Arabia. And now, back to Colin.
I know. I just can't wait. Mark Silk, who is something of an expert at Trinity on politics and religion, will be joining me for that, for some of that show anyway, if not all of it. All right. It's time to make some recommendations. Let's start with you, Carolyn.
All right. My recommendation is another Amazon Prime series that I did want to watch more than one episode of. It's in its third season, Catastrophe. It is so brilliant. And this season is kind of bittersweet because Carrie Fisher is in it. And it's actually the last project that she filmed. And it is just, it is so funny and so raw. And Sharon Horgan, who's this British, I think she's actually Irish comedian who co-created this, is brilliant. I just completely idolize her, and everyone should check out this series.
All right. Okay. And Irene, what have you got for us?
Three things. One, male rompers.
yes.
Two, Get Out, which we talked about on the Nose once, right. Is playing at Cine Studio tonight and tomorrow. Mm. And it's such a great thing to watch on the big screen, a cross between a horror movie and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And so if you haven't seen it, go to Cine Studio, and just go to Cine Studio in general because they have great movies there. Also, my colleague from Trinity, Pablo Delano, who's a photographer, is having an exhibit at the Hartford Public Library. There's an opening tonight at 6, but the pictures will be there for a while. He takes beautiful photographs, and these are of Hartford's built environment, so it's all very local, and you can find the places that he's photographed, and I think it should be a lovely exhibit.
Did you want to say like 30 seconds about what you mean when you say male rompers?
Yes. Rompers that look like what little kids wear or what Caroline has. Caroline
has a business romper today. Mm-hmm. It looks like I'm ready to do some business in this nice blouse and shorts, but it's our skort, really. And but yeah, I think rompers are great. And
they started with babies, then they went to women, to girls and women.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're very popular with women. Like
rompers for everyone.
Caroline.
I'm all for it.
Now men are wearing them.
Yeah.
All right.
I approve.
All right.
For me.
You're not wearing a romper. I want to vouch for that. Rich Holland
but you
is
would.
Not wearing a romper.
Without a doubt. So TheaterWorks is opening a new play called Fade by Tanya Sirocco. My take on it is it's about the degeneration of authenticity when art and commerce intersect. When TheaterWorks does these openings, they create an event called Meet the Artist. That's happening on the 24th, which is Wednesday of this week, like 6:30 or so, in the gallery at TheaterWorks. I happen to be the artist that they will be meeting, one of the artists. So I've got an exhibit of my work there. The show's called This Time is Kinda Like the Last Time. And as a bonus for folks who are showing up at the opening, I'll be doing actual artwork with the folks who are there. So we'll be making stuff together. So
all right,
happening.
That sounds great. All right, so in honor of Chris Cornell and the conversation we just had, I decided I would make musical recommendations, one very old and one very new. So the very old one is, although he's also very new, I guess, the voice that you hear usually at the end of the Nose, and I think you'll be hearing today, belongs to Grayson Hugh. Grayson Hugh is one of the first live musicians, I think, you know, that I heard as a young guy. He was a musician around here. I imprinted on him like a baby duck. I've always loved his music. He'll be performing tonight at Center Church right in downtown Hartford at 7 p.m. with Polly Messer. Always worth it. Amazing voice, amazing way with what is sometimes called blue-eyed soul. I also want to recommend, and couldn't be newer than this, the rapper Logic has just dropped an album called Everybody. It's the third in what I think is a four-album sequence. I didn't know much about him, but this is one of these things where you really have to spend time with the album, too. You can't cherry-pick it very well, I don't think. Although if you want to listen to, say, one song, I would recommend Confess, which involves Killer Mike as well. It's amazing. The critics have not been super kind to this, but I actually regard it as just a virtuosic performance, both musically and verbally, and it's very much about his own split identity. He's biracial, but it's about a lot of other stuff, too. I don't know how... if you have any threshold for this, any ability to listen to hip-hop music, which I realize is perhaps a small percentage of the public radio audience, please engage a little bit with this. Everybody by Logic. All right, thanks so much to Rich Holland and to Irene Papoulis and to Carolyn Payne. We'll see you on Monday. Should be an exciting day. Mondays seem to be very exciting these days, but then so do Tuesdays.
Avon, Farmington. Yeah. On the radio. She on the radio.
On the radio, baby.
Hey, do you want to, I don't know, get more comfortable? You want to stay over?
Yeah. Let me just get out of this romper.
No, no, no. Keep it on.